Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC bunker at the North Carolina Legislature, it's Friday, April 21st, 2017. I'm Jeff DeBerry. Welcome to the podcast. Your guest this week is a newspaper hack turned multimedia reporter, transformed back into a digital political reporter. Is that the best way to do this?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Okay. Mark Binker is here from the North Carolina Insider to pontificate and analyze and just share other musings about the week that was here at the General Assembly. Mark, let's start with your top two or three, if you dare, stories from what was, I would dare call, a cluttered week.
Yeah, it was a cluttered week. It makes picking out any one thing kind of difficult. I would say the billboard madness, not madness, but the couple of billboard bills that popped up on Thursday. Representative David Lewis has these that basically would make it easier for the billboard industry to either relocate or get compensated for billboards that are displaced for one reason or another. It seems like every session has its billboard bills, and you know, I saw these pop up, and I went, "Oh, okay, here we are. I'm comfortable again."
Yeah, yes.
It's nice to see you all.
What has happened? So I guess we'll back up just a second. Who's opposed to this, and what has happened previously with these billboard proposals?
So the typical battle lines are the industry on one hand saying, hey, we're small business operators, and we just need some latitude to operate in the state, and current rules are slowing our roll, essentially. And then on the other end of things, you typically have folks who are in the environmental spectrum of groups and cities a lot of times because – and to give billboards freer rein, you're necessarily either doing things like, you know, cutting down trees, which environmental folks don't like, or restricting how cities can regulate billboards in their territory. So this week was a really good example of that. You saw people saying, hey, you're going to create more clutter, more visual clutter along the roadways. And by the way, you're going to override local ordinances about where billboards can go. And the pushback was, but we're just trying to make sure that we don't lose our stuff that, you know, when we're told to take a billboard down, we can put it up somewhere, or at least get compensated for it. And this is the typical back and forth that comes along every year.
In addition to billboards, we saw a number of things this week, of fiscal analysis of what Senate tax cuts would do. Yep. We saw a craft beer proposal abandoned. We saw environmental regs and more court. I'm trying to remember if we saw court legislation. What's one other that jumps out to you from this week?
So the beer bill getting rolled back or fizzling, you know, headline writers had a field day with that one.
You're a punny guy. Were there any puns you sat on with that?
Oh, no, me. I would never. Okay. The beer bill, which has been this sort of craft freedom movement asking that small brewers be able to distribute on their own more than 25,000 barrels of beer, which is quite a bit, you know, especially to drink. But you know, in terms of distribution, it's not a huge amount of distribution. And you have some of the smaller brewers in the state getting up against that limit and saying, right, hey, we don't want to be forced to go to a wholesaler to distribute, which is what current state law requires once you hit that 25K mark. That provision, along with one other that would sort of make franchise agreements tilt a little bit more toward the brewers themselves rather than the wholesalers.
A little looser. I mean, is that a fair word?
I mean, basically, it would give brewers the ability to get out of them more easily. They wouldn't have to show cause or show the same kind of cause that they did now. Those were kind of two big controversial provisions. And the first time those two provisions really, you know, they've been coming up for years, but this was kind of the first year where you looked at it and went, man, they have a legit shot of getting this done.
Right.
And just late one night, Representative McGrady put out a proposed committee substitute just a rewrite of this bill without those two things in there. And he called him up and asked, hey, where'd this go? And he said, yeah, we just couldn't get him passed. You know, even if we got him out of committee, we don't know that we could get him off the House floor. And even if we got it off the House floor, they were dead in the water in the Senate. So we're doing a lot of other things that are kind of small, good for brewers, but aren't the two big marquee provisions.
Right. And it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting issue on a couple of fronts, the small business free enterprise, and also the folks that are behind this effort to raise the cap. I mean, I think I said in one piece it's hipsters to libertarians or hipsters to conservatives. I mean, it's really a big range. And it sounds like they are pursuing, I mean, not sounds like, they are pursuing a legal challenge now of the constitutionality to this cap. What's your initial reaction or thought on that?
Well, you know, if you sat down and you talked to somebody who's never heard of the three-tier system and, you know, you think about, okay, you're a toy manufacturer. How can you sell your toys? Well, you can sell it out the front of the store. You can sell it to toy shops. You can sell it to a distributor. You have sort of all these options available to you. For some reason in the beer business, you have to go through a wholesaler, by and large, where you're required to turn your product over to somebody else who then sells it to retail locations and restaurants. And that was, you know, that's a prohibition era thing that was done to make sure that taxes got collected and, you know, beer didn't get pushed on unsuspecting people or people had enough or what have you. But it seems zany to people these days, right?
Yes.
And you know, so they're heading to court. You know, this system's been around for almost a century now.
Right.
It seems like if it were unconstitutional, somebody would have brought this case, but
the market maybe hasn't driven anybody to challenge it until now.
Well, and you know, there's also an argument that, you know, back when it was first developed, the system was meant to keep big brewers in check,
yes,
right? And now critics of it say, look, it's really empowering big brewers to have to dominate the market, and it's keeping little guys down, and it's anti-competitive. So, you know, maybe just reality moving under the feet of this thing will have created the a successful challenge. I don't know.
And Kraft, I think, has only about 12% of the market at this point, which is kind of an interesting subplot to this whole conversation about beer. It's not as though Kraft drives the market. They might be driving the growth or the change of the market.
What we've heard during a lot of these discussions is that, you know, while Kraft has been growing, you haven't seen excise taxes growing, right? And you would expect that excise taxes, which are charged on the amount of beer you're selling, would grow if you're seeing this big boom in the industry. And what the craft brewers have said is, no. We're not really developing new drinkers. We're not selling a lot of new beer in the state overall. What we're doing is we're taking market share from the big guys, and that's why the big guys are freaking out. You know, yeah, they're still a small segment, but I think they would make the case that the national and international brewers are fighting this really hard because they're seeing their markets erode.
All right. That was this week at the General Assembly. Obviously, many more things took place. You can find out more at WUNC.org, and you can also find out what is happening on a regular basis at the North Carolina Insider, which is where Mark Binker works. We'll chat about that in just a bit. We're going to chat about journalism here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. Next week here, first, before we get to that, is Crossover.
Yes.
I would like for you, as someone who's been around here, how long have you covered the legislature?
Full-time since 2005.
Okay. So 12 years. You proceed, you have tenure, you rank on many of the lawmakers who are here. I would like to hear from you concisely, if you can, a case for why Crossover is relevant and important and garners all the attention it does, and then, maybe in the same voice or in a different one, a case for why Crossover is total BS.
So this is a perfect example of the rules being the rules up until they're not the rules anymore, right? Crossover is there to control the flow of legislation, to make sure that the sessions end at some point. Because in North Carolina, we don't have constitutional session limits, which means sessions can go on and on and on, and we've been around for some that have for various reasons. Crossover is a kind of discipline. It says if you've got a bill that's just dealing with policy, it's not monkeying around with the state budget, it's not doing other things, you've got to get it through one chamber or the other by a date certain so that we just know what the universe of stuff is.
Cross it over to the other
chamber. That's get, yeah, cross it over to the other chamber. What we quickly find out is that, like a lot of other rules, crossover applies to those in the legislative minority, Democrats this year, and folks who are not in the legislative leadership. Because as soon as we get past crossover, then we open up the playbook of things that we use to get around crossover rules. Basically, I think it sticks around because it's a form of discipline. It allows law, it gives legislative leaders who are trying to manage 170 personalities a way to just sort of begin drawing a line under this thing, a way to plausibly get out of town mm-hmm. without just saying, we don't want to do it. You know, you can look at somebody and say, oh, sorry, missed crossover, bro.
It's a way to effectively kill policy or mark the end of policy efforts for this session.
Yeah, or at least create the bubble of policy efforts, okay. right? You know, the things that are alive that you will have, you will have discussions about, and, you know, remember this is a 2-year session, so there are ways that bills can come up in the second year session, but you know, it's basically sort of circumscribing the arena. Where are we going to have our fights? You know, and then all the stuff that kind of gets around the crossover rules are things that you can rightly see as sort of high priorities for the corner offices.
So now tell me why it is a completely arbitrary date and overappreciated, perhaps.
Well,
and if you disagree with that assertion, please tell me why.
Well, it is an arbitrary date because they have to circle some date on the
sure.
calendar. The reason it might be a little bit overblown is because even if your bill, your big idea misses crossover, there are ways for it to hitch a ride on other things. You can throw it into the budget. You can find a technical corrections bill. You can find some sort of omnibus to tack it into. You can find what we finally refer to around here as a vehicle, which is a bill that comes over from the other chamber, maybe isn't going to pass as its current thing, but hey, you can clean that thing out, put in a brand new interior and send it back. So there are ways around the rules. That said, for you know, those people finding ways around the rules tend to be either folks in leadership or promoting ideas that have the blessing of leadership. It's not just every random little thing that's going to find its way around. So, which is why I say, you know, the rules apply until they don't. And yes, it is a little bit overblown, and we have this week of just stuff chaotically pushing through and, you know, late nights and long days and committee meetings sure. with 20 bills on the calendar. And, you know, yeah, it's a little bit of a spectacle, but.
But this entire place is a little bit of a spectacle.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, you gotta have some guidelines. You gotta have some rules. Even if you're busy finding ways around the rules, you gotta have some rules, some way to kind of mark time. And this is a big way to kind of mark the time and the rhythm of the place.
Fair enough. There's got to be a framework in order to have a game of
yeah.
some sort. So you mentioned before you've been here full time for 12 years, covering the General Assembly almost 20 years, going back.
Well, not
that long.
I came up part time session help in like 2003 and 2004.
Okay.
But
okay.
2005. I mean, I've been in the state since 2000, and you know.
Sure. Okay. So you mentioned before you've been at the General Assembly going back 12 years full time. Interested in what you think the biggest or some of the biggest misconceptions about the legislature are from folks that don't spend a lot of time here, aren't within kind of this political bubble that we are.
Oh, I think one of them that we saw in the past week was just because a bill is filed, it means it's going to happen. You know,
right.
you know this and I know this, you know, lawmakers will sometimes file things that folks on the outside world look at and just consider zany and kind of overreact to, even though, you know, I know, and most of the people around here know, oh, well, that's going to get filed away in some committee and it's never going to be heard from again. I think if I could do one thing, just sort of tempering the reaction, just because one lawmaker has a bad idea mm-hmm. does not mean every other lawmaker is going to
or even
adopt
a majority
that idea.
Will support it. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The other thing is that, all Democrats think the same or all Republicans think the same.
Right.
You know, a Republican
mm-hmm.
is not a Republican is not a Republican.
Right.
A Democrat is not a Democrat is not a Democrat. They represent kind of diverse things. And just because person one thinks one thing does not mean everybody else in their party is going along with it. And you see that show up a lot around these really close bills where they're trying to figure out, okay, do we have the votes for this? You know, just on substantive, normal policy stuff. And you have these sort of basic disagreements within the party. So it's always a bad idea just to assume, oh, because one Republican thinks one thing or one Democrat thinks one thing, everybody else in their party thinks along the same lines.
Right, right. Interested on a different note, to whatever extent you can share, will share, what are your news consumption habits? What do you read and how or on what devices or when or where? Like, when do you... How do you do news? You're a news junkie. Yeah.
I mean, we all are. I mean, everybody right. in this business is. I am somewhat omnivorous, and you know, part of that right now is because, you know, part of the service that the Insider offers is kind of a news roundup. So we have to sort of be cast a wide net in terms of state. I like reading about stuff that I don't know about. So I read a lot about Congress and the president, you know, because we're not up there and covering that. So I'm kind of, okay, tell me what's going on at the federal level. I still get magazines and newspapers at the house. I'm weird and old school like that. But I very much do like just the ability to, you know, sample online. And quite frankly, a lot of, you know, because I'm friends with a lot of journalists on mm-hmm. social media, I like when they say, hey, you should read this story, or this has a really good turn of phrase, or, you know, hate read something. You know, this was so bad, you got to go look at it, and then we can talk about how awful it is. So I particularly enjoy suggestions from other folks who do our job, who see something they either just really appreciate as a good work or bad work or what have you.
So the NC Insider or North Carolina Insider?
We're not all that particular. Most okay. people just call us the Insider
right,
around here.
Right, that's what I call you all.
Yeah.
So the Insider does a news roundup, which is very important, has helped me get up to speed at times, occasionally. And also there's a bill tracking service.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your last role and tell me about what you are now doing at the Insider, how it has transformed. I mean, is it a different role or no? I mean, you're covering this place, yes, but
yeah.
Now you're writing a weekly column.
Yeah, so you know, I've had three jobs covering the General Assembly. I've been the bureau chief for the Greensboro newspaper, and then I went over to work for a television station, which obviously has its perils that you appear on television from time to time.
That tends to be the case.
And wrote a lot for the WRAL website. I've been in the new job for about a month, which has kind of three big pieces to it. So the Insider itself is a subscription service. A lot of, you know, journalists get it, lawmakers, legislators, you know, our audience is really the people who operate in and around this building and need to know what's going on.
Right.
And we try to not just be a news roundup, but also break news to provide things that mm-hmm. are useful, maybe to have eyes and be paying attention to where others aren't. The one other side business is the column that goes out to small newspapers around the state is just kind of a part of our what we call Capital Press Association. We move some content to smaller papers who don't have bureaus down here, who, you know, just as a way of keeping those folks informed. And then, of course, the Insider is owned by the News and Observer. So we have a relationship where sometimes what we're writing and working on will be picked up and used by the News and Observer in various ways. So it's kind of a multifaceted little
sure.
organization.
The biggest journalism story perhaps this week, or the biggest story that I feel free to disagree. I think the biggest story this week that was tethered to journalism was the separation between Fox News and Bill O'Reilly. And this, you know, this is something that it's not a new saga, but I think it was renewed, and I think the spotlight was brightened after this story from the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. I guess using that as a vehicle to ask this question, I don't know what question I want to ask. I'm gonna ask this question. What is your a little bit more context? So this was something that I think that watchdogs and journalists were, regardless of how you feel about Bill O'Reilly, I think pivoted and said, hey, newspaper, investigative newspaper reporting is still very important. And that's where a lot of that's ultimately still what journalism boils down to. So I have stammered through this for 3.5 minutes here. My question is, what is your level of optimism and hope for journalism? Tethering that to O'Reilly and talking about that, if you want to, or just the present state of things.
Okay, well,
great question by me, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, boy, let's pick this apart. So O'Reilly, I don't know. Is it okay if I say, you know, really what he's been doing hasn't been a ton of journalism in the last few years?
Sure.
And, you know, those big cable news personalities, you know, a lot of them sit in a studio and don't really commit what, you know, we do on day to day of doing the really hard stuff of following committing
sources, right?
Yeah, committing meetings and all that. I mean, just following along and telling people, you know. But if you're asking about sort of big J journalism, you know, investigative stuff as well as just the, you know, the person who goes down to City Hall and reports on, you know, your city council decided to raise your taxes or pave the street or whatever it is, you know, we see the need for that. There is the demand for that. What we haven't really done a great job as an industry figuring out is how to pay for that stuff.
Right.
And we see that every day. I mean, we see that actually in a bill that's down here at the General Assembly, where they're looking at moving legal notices out of newspapers and onto government websites. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, we had a small newspaper publisher come and say, hey, that's 5% of my business right there. Right? Now you can make the argument that
the market should play.
Yeah, I mean, why should the government be subsidizing a bit, you know, a business model that obviously is having trouble sustaining itself? But if you look around and you say, oh, well, we're really, you know, the people who come down here and they're really upset about the teacher funding, you know, they're looking to somebody to kind of say, what's going on with this? Why did this happen? Who's going to fix it? How can we? So the demand is there. And what we've got to figure out as an industry is how to pay for it. And that's what a lot of us are working on. You know, whether you're talking about somebody like Rose Hoban at North Carolina Health News, who's got a nonprofit news site and is looking for, you know, grants and to do things that way, whether you're talking about traditional media like newspapers and television stations that are trying to figure out, all right, how do we make this model work for another 100 years? Or, you know, folks like me who are kind of weirdly patching together a lot of revenue streams to make it work.
Right.
We're all asking the same question. How do we take something that is a public service, what I believe is a public good, and make a living out of it?
I will note, and I didn't ask this question because of it, we do have a pledge drive coming up next week. and then there's public radio, right? And public radio, I think there is certainly a spectrum within the hundreds of public radio stations across the country, some of which are strong and vibrant and others doing well and viable, and others that are largely dependent on federal money and grants and depending on what happens with the budget in the coming months. The next year and a half could be a time of major transition for public radio. So it's very interesting. Last question. You've heard this before. You don't want to hear it, but give me a date as to when you think we're out of here for the year.
Oh.
It's a fun one to play.
I tend to say that July 4th is sort of my barometer. If we get out before July 4th, it's been a fine session. If we get out after July 4th, it's beginning to get into that, man, we've been around here for a while, it's getting musty, we need to move along. It feels to me like this is a faster year than a slower year, so I'm going to say July 3rd.
Mark it down.
Yeah.
Mark Binker of The Insider, your guest on the WUNC Politics Podcast this week. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
That's all for this edition of the program. Share the episode on Twitter or Facebook and subscribe on Google Play, Stitcher, and, of course, iTunes. You can find the latest political news on our website throughout the week at WUNC.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. We just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.